Joseph.
The Disciplined Investor is all about you, your money, and the markets. Sit back and get ready for this edition of the Disciplined Investor Podcast.
This episode of the Disciplined Investor is sponsored by Horowitz & Company. If you're looking for a portfolio manager, look no further. Horowitz & Company, from seed through harvest, cultivating financial success.
This podcast was brought to you by LivePerson.com. LivePerson.com, a world of experts.
Welcome aboard. This is Andrew Horowitz, and you're listening to the Disciplined Investor Podcast. This is called episode number 83, and we are in the throes of misery. I don't care about that just wacky move last week on Thursday when we saw the markets just explode for absolutely no reason. But what I do care about is what's going to happen and how we're going to deal with this. So what I thought I would do is bring a couple of people that you haven't heard from for a really long time. One of them is Eric Savitz. He's the Barron's technology writer, Tech Trader Daily. And I want to find out, because, you know, we thought for a while that maybe that technology was safe, right, and many of the technology stocks. But then we started seeing some really crazy things happening in the last couple of weeks in terms of earnings and outlooks. And particularly with Intel. So let's and Sun, by the way, Sun Microsystems. But we'll talk with him. And I also had Howard Silverblatt from Standard & Poor's, because earnings obviously are driving everything crazy right now. And I think that it would really be helpful to look at the S&P 500 and the constituents to see really what's the makeup. And I want to understand a little bit more about how the financials are really affecting things, and understand some of the outlook and what we should be looking forward to, or not, for that matter. Last week, obviously, was a difficult one in that we saw earnings just all over the place. Retail looked abysmal, and I think that we're going to see a lot more of that coming up. But more so, the concern over GM and the real big problem that we have when it comes to TARP, and now Paulson just pulling the plug on his original plan, which was the stabilization package, and seems to be switching gears a little bit now, and really without a lot of explanation, although I posted an interview on the site, thedisciplinedinvestor.com, that he did late last week, and I think it was kind of interesting as his explanation. But still, it's really concerning, because it shows us the lack of real insight into the problem and more so the solution. So I think that's a really, really big issue. We saw mutual funds again trade off the short positions that we're holding. They sold off dramatically. Like Mason was down, so was Ben and Franklin Resources, that is, and T. Rowe. And the mutual funds are really taking it on the chin. Interestingly, reports that we've been watching in terms of mutual fund outflows, I think, is telling an interesting story. Some people are trying to turn around and say that it's a contrarian indicator, the amount of money that's coming out of mutual funds right now, but I disagree. I think that it's just the beginning, because a lot of people are really taking money out to cover expenses that they have. And as we're seeing, even as we're seeing oil hit down to, what, about $57, $58 a barrel, give or take, the fact of the matter is, even though gas is coming down in price, many people are having some real difficulty out there, and that's what's happening in terms of the consumer numbers that we saw and the retail spending that we saw last week. So looking forward, maintaining the position in a hedged portfolio, where we are maintaining a neutral stance and then moving it depending on the current market indications. Until we can get some real solid footing, I think is going to be the name of the game. And with that, I think that when we continue to see the earnings come out and the projections, even if there is some great stimulus package by the U.S. and the G20 comes out with something more than just a simple, well, we're going to really try hard, is what they seem to do over the weekend. GM is really weighing heavily on people, and there's going to be a big debate raging in Congress this week. So with that, why don't we get into these discussions and talk directly with the experts in this area, and hopefully I'm hoping we can get a little resolution and maybe a, more of a clarification on the outlook. That's the main thing. Beyond that, we wrote an economic commentary last week, and again, looking at every economic indicator right now, forward and in a rearview mirror approach, it definitely seems that, I don't see anything more than a trend that continues down for the near term. So fourth quarter is going to probably continue to be difficult with spurts of moving on the up and the down. Obviously, we may see another retest of that low potentially of the 7,800. If we continue to see very concerning economic and earnings releases, as there is really no, I think there's nothing on the horizon right now that's cooking with a lame duck Congress, and that really could spark some enthusiasm right now. And the longer this goes, obviously the enthusiasm wanes a bit. So so with that, let's get on with this discussion, and we'll turn over the experts. We'll be right back. Hang on the Disciplined Investor Podcast.
Hi, I'm David James. I'm an expert to the world
in spirituality.
There are millions of experts who are brilliant in the kinds of things everyone needs answers to.
Hi, my name is Larry Doan. I'm an immigration lawyer in Los Angeles.
Now you can chat with them live, online, and benefit from their knowledge.
Hi, I'm Jamie Parker, a public relations specialist and an expert to the world on LivePerson.com.
There's a world of experts on LivePerson.com. Chat live. It's free to start. LivePerson.com, a world of experts.
So before we get on with this today, I just want to remind you that if you want to visit some of the things that we're doing and watch some of the similar things that we're doing with the TDI Managed Growth Strategy, not exactly, you can visit the MSN Money Strategy Lab, where I think my portfolio is up right now 10.98% since August 1st. And I think right now we're in first place, but that could switch around. We're right now in cash because we saw a lot of disruption about a week and a half ago in the markets, and I felt that it was more prudent to be on the sidelines looking for opportunities. And in fact, I have found a few. You'll see some things happening next week. So make sure to subscribe to Disciplined Investor. Check it regularly. We'll post it there. And if you haven't done so, sign up for Twitter, Andrew Horowitz. That's my Twitter name. And you'll get alerts from the website right there directly. All right, we have a very, very special treat today. We're going to be talking with a good friend of mine. We haven't talked in some time, Eric Savitz from Barron's. He's the technology writer and also blogger from Barron's. Has his pulse and finger on the pulse of the technology sector. So welcome aboard, Eric.
Yeah, thanks for having me back.
So there's been a lot of talk lately. Obviously, we talk about the news. The news has been just overflowing with all sorts of things from every direction. But technology, as once hoped to be the bastion of hope for this economy, has been coming under some serious fire lately.
Yeah, it's been a rough few weeks for the earnings coming from the technology sector, and I think that what we're seeing is, there have been some hopes that the tech sector would be immune to the downturn in the economy. But the downturn in the economy has been severe enough that those hopes have kind of been dashed, and for two basic reasons. If you think about, at a very basic level, where the demand for technology goods and services come from, they come from two places. They come from the consumer, who buys computers and cell phones and big screen TVs and everything else that they sell in consumer electronics stores, and they come from corporations who are buying computers and servers and software and all those things they need to run their business. Well, what we have right now is kind of a perfect storm. We have a consumer that is really having a tough year. We've got, as everyone knows, we've got people losing jobs. We have the value of people's homes going down. We have people who are losing a lot of money in their stock portfolios. So the consumer is under assault, and meanwhile, corporate spending is going down. And so we have an environment in which people are spending less on technology of pretty much every variety, and it's hitting earnings. We've had a long series of in the last few weeks warnings from some of the largest companies in the tech business that the fourth quarter is going to be nasty, and next year will probably remain not a good time for tech companies.
So you wrote an article on the 14th just this week on titled "Tech Job Losses Headed for the Worst Year Since 2003," and just to kind of harken back to that period, that was kind of the end of the time where maybe we call it an earnings capitulation, right, where everybody just threw their hands up saying, or corporations, that is, saying that, you know what, we just can't keep anybody on. We've done our best. We've blown through every bit of capital that we had, especially for the startups, and we kind of just have to just lay everybody off and regroup and see if we can move forward. Right now, I guess Challenge at Grain Christmas came out with a report that shows that I guess we're potentially, at the current pace, total job loss for the year could reach 180,000, just shy about maybe 40,000 in 2003. But I guess, does this have anything to do with some of the outsourcing we did as well? I mean, is this just localized to the U.S., or is this whole technology issue a much bigger concern on a global basis?
Well, so this is a global problem. I mean, this started as a U.S. problem. If you look back, the earliest signs of trouble here happened about a year ago. You can almost date it to the November conference call that Cisco did after their earnings report last November, and they talked about how there were some signs of weakness in their U.S. enterprise business. And in fact, the NASDAQ had basically peaked, as it turned out, we now know, a few days earlier. Halloween 2007 was the most recent high on the NASDAQ, and it's been pretty much downhill from there. And what we've seen initially gradually over the course of the last year is some signs of weakness in the U.S. enterprise market. But what's become clear over in recent weeks is that the weakness has spread from the U.S. And then to Europe, and then as John Chambers talked about on their most recent earnings call, from Europe it spread into the emerging markets and also into mainstream Asia, and there are signs of slowdown in places like China and Japan. So it's everywhere, we have an economy that is integrally coupled with the economies in Asia and Europe, and everyone is suffering at the same time. Now, I think this is not an outsourcing issue. This is a basic demand, supply and demand issue. So, you know, when you look at the most recent few weeks and look at some of the layoff announcements that have happened, it goes from companies in all parts of the technology landscape. The most dramatic one was just on Friday. We had Sun Microsystems announced that they're going to lay off 6,000 people. We've had internet companies like Yahoo and eBay make layoff announcements. We've had lots of layoffs in the semiconductor equipment business. Applied Materials is laying off about 12% of their staff. They, of course, are the largest player in that business. Semiconductor companies like National Semi and Cypress Semiconductor and others are laying people off. So it's really, and in fact, there's also been layoffs in places that you might think would be somewhat more resistant, mm-hmm. like in the video game business where THQ, for example, one of the kind of big three players in video games, is laying off about 20% of their staff. So it's kind of everywhere.
Getting back to National Semi and Applied Materials, for example, that concerns me. I'll tell you why. What that tells me is, and back me up or tell me I have no idea here, but that tells me that orders aren't coming in, because it's one thing to project and look out and find from your buyers, if you will, or you know who you're supplying, what's going on, and then trying to trim back and be careful and not get, you know, don't have too much inventory and take it easy on production. It's another thing cutting jobs in this area, because now what we're finding, or it seems to me, you can infer that clearly the orders are not only not coming in, but they're not really gearing them up to come in too quickly at this level of cuts.
Yeah, I think it's definitely true that they're not seeing orders. Applied Materials, in fact, forecast that orders in Q4 would be down about 30%. They're from a year ago. Revenues are down 25 or 30% from a year ago for them. Now, I mean, the semiconductor equipment business is, of course, involves very large very large price tag pieces of equipment, and they are a sign of what is happening elsewhere in the food chain. So, you know, essentially, they prosper when the semiconductor industry is spending money to add capacity. When the semiconductor industry is seeing excess capacity, they stop buying equipment, and that's exactly what they've done. And the reason the semiconductor equipment industry is seeing soft demand is because the end market, the market for personal computers and for cell phones and other goods, is softening considerably. One of the real shocks last week, late in the week, was Nokia. There were a couple of them.
Oh, yeah.
Nokia announced that they now think that phone handset sales will be down in 2009 from 2008. Now, this is an industry that sells huge numbers of units. You're talking, you know, a billion units or more a year worldwide. They have historically grown around 10% a year in terms of units. This is the industry as a whole. Nokia being one of the biggest players, they have a pretty good view on how things are going, and they're now saying that next year is going to be a down year. They cut their forecast also for Q4. But so the handset industry is shrinking. And then meanwhile, we had Intel last week do something that was kind of shocking, which is they just a month earlier had issued guidance for the fourth quarter that they would do about a little over $10 billion in revenue in Q4. And then a month later came back and said the number would be as much as $1.5 billion below what they had originally expected. This is, you know, 4 weeks, and they this, you know, a little over 4 weeks later, they've dramatically reduced their expectations for the quarter. So,
yeah. No, I mean, so here's another question I have in terms of this. I want to get to a question if there's going to be a bright spot, but I want to ask something before I forget this. We were both around back in 2000, let's go back further, 1999, and the unbelievable birth of technology, or at least the growth of technology, and then, of course, the unfortunate events that happened from the bubble bursting at that point. But one of the things that I remember happening very distinctly was there was this real concern, and it initially played out this way, that there was a kind of a smothering of innovation, right? Because there was no more money. People in the VC area, which was the incubators for many of the small companies that would maybe be the eBay of tomorrow, and maybe that's a bad example, but of Google of tomorrow, of whatever it may be, there was people that had very aggressive abilities. They would take money and they would basically say, here's $10 million, $1 million, and do what you will with it. We have a good belief in what you do, but if we lose it, that's pretty much it. It's not going to be either like a slow growth. It's either going to make it or break it. The question is the risk tolerance for investors right now, losing it on all fronts, right? Real estate, stocks and stocks, bonds. I mean, any way you want to look, they're losing money. Even some are losing money in cash, it seems, these days. Does that pose a concern of yours about innovation moving forward?
Well, I mean, certainly there's going to be an impact on the startup world and on the venture capital business, and for a few reasons. So, for starters, there's essentially no IPO market right now. So we've had an unbelievably small number of venture-backed IPOs over the last 12 months, and it's been weeks since we've had any, and it's unlikely that we'll see any for a while to come. There's just no appetite for the risk involved in taking small companies public. So that's one problem. A second problem is that there's much reduced M&A activity. So at one level, you'd think, wow, valuations are down. You know, that's an opportunity for large companies to expand by acquisition. The problem is no one wants to sell when their valuation is low, and companies that have the capital to make acquisitions
don't necessarily
want to spend until they have clarity on where things are going. So there's not much room for M&A. There's no IPO market. So as a result, venture-backed companies are having to kind of hunker down and know that they're going to have to survive on the cash that they have available. And so what you're seeing is a couple of things happen. One, you're seeing smaller companies make the same kind of job cuts and cost cuts that you're seeing larger companies make. So, you know, they don't make as much news because they're, You know, if you have a company of 100 people and you cut 10% of your staff and it's 10 people, that might not make the front page of the Wall Street Journal. But those kinds of things are happening all over the valley where you're seeing companies tighten up. There have been some high-profile examples of venture capitalists issuing kind of reading the riot act to their portfolio companies, basically telling them, look, we're in for tough times. You need to cut unnecessary costs. You need to be smarter about choosing how to spend your development dollars. There will always be a market for truly innovative companies, and people who are true innovators will continue to find ways to get their projects off the ground. But there's certainly no doubt that the whole process is going to slow down. I mean, I saw something at the end of last week about some data on how I think this was a Bloomberg story about the secondary market for interest in venture capital funds has plummeted dramatically. And by what I mean by that is, if you're an institution and you own $100 million worth of some large venture fund, and then you decide to sell that position, that's not like going out and selling a block of Microsoft shares. There's a pretty specific kind of, almost like a brokered kind of market. It's like buying a house or selling a house in a certain way. And the market for those positions helps you get a sense on what the valuation is for venture-backed companies. And the valuation on those positions has dropped by some estimates as much as 50%, which is, sounds shocking. Until you look at what's happened to the public markets, where you're seeing similar sized losses. So there is going to be some impact on the innovation economy as well.
All right. So where is, if any, if you could even have to grasp at something? I'm not one of these silver lining kind of people, right? But what, if anything, looks good? If anything, I mean, Google looks like crap because now we're realizing they're an advertising company. And really, for the most part, what do they really have besides advertising to boost up their revenue? I mean, it's
light. Here's what I'd say about that. It's very difficult to pick bottom. So, I don't like to be in the business of trying to say, well, we've hit the bottom. And we've seen days. Last week, we had a dramatic rally on Thursday, and then we got some more bad news on Friday, and the stock sold off again. So it's very difficult to pick a bottom, and it's going to be rocky, I think, for the next few months at least, until we get some sign that the decline in earnings is going to slow down. I mean, now this has turned into a different animal than the way this downturn started off. This started off as a downturn based on shocks to the financial system, the collapse of Bear Stearns and the collapse of Lehman Brothers and AIG and all those things that happened, and a lack of confidence in the system. And now we've hit a sort of secondary wave, which is the fact that earnings are coming in dramatically below where people expected, particularly as they look out to the fourth quarter. So we're not at the end of this yet. I mean, I would say, however, that one thing that has happened is that we've already taken out a lot of the risk. So if you look at companies that are, this is a good time to hide out in quality. It's not a very good time to try and bet on turnarounds. If you look at companies that are highly leveraged, that are going to need to do capital raises to turn around, companies like, say, AMD or Motorola or Sprint, companies like that, even large companies, but that have a dependence on the capital markets to raise more capital in the next 12 months, those things are things that I would not go near. On the other hand, there are some tech companies out there sitting on huge cash positions, and things like Apple and Cisco and Microsoft and Google, and there are some others where they now have a large portion of their valuation is in cash. And so, are they going to be affected by this? Absolutely, they are. I mean, I wrote this weekend about how Microsoft's estimates are almost certainly now too high. The expectations they had for PC unit growth are too high, but they're sitting on a huge amount of cash. When we get through this process that we're working our way through, And I think this was the case in the last, you know, the last downturn, and will be the case in the next one, is that the, you know, the rich tend to get richer. You know, this is a time to consolidate your position. You know, if you're Cisco, you may not be ready to pull the trigger on acquisitions quite yet, but you're getting ready. So, you know, you'll see Oracle do more acquisitions. You'll see Microsoft make some acquisitions. I think what you'll begin to see is some smaller players fall off. There are some particular industries where segments of the tech landscape where, you know, you'll begin to see players just fall off and in bankruptcy or otherwise just wither away. I mean, we've had a few of those already. I mean, we saw in the consumer electronics retailing space where Circuit City just filed Chapter 11. You know, there's a lot of concern about the players in the memory chip business where they're dramatically oversupplied in terms of capacity. Some of those companies go away. So, you know, it's a little bit of a Darwinian process we're going through, where the strong will survive, some of the weak ones will get killed off or acquired. If I was looking for places to put money, if you had a sufficiently long-term perspective, I think I would look at, you know, strong names, companies with extremely strong balance sheets, where their competitive position is very strong. So even if you think about Google, for example, Google's stock has come down very dramatically, right? Their stock was down around $300. It has traded in the past above $700. And in fact, recently was down below $300. Are they going to get affected by this? Yeah, because the advertising market for every medium, whether it's online or radio or television or whatever, is clearly going to slow. Online ad revenues should still grow next year, but not nearly at the rate we've seen in previous years. But keep in mind that from a competitive position, they control more than 70% of the search market. Search advertising is likely to do a little bit better than display advertising on the web. So they're pretty well positioned. You know, Microsoft is well positioned. Apple is well positioned. Cisco is well positioned. Oracle is well positioned. Are the stocks as low as they're going to go? You know, I don't know.
Let me ask you about something that you know, it would seem for a while it looked like. Well, let's just go back a little bit. I don't know if the faux pas of the year is going to be the Jerry Yang story or not in the technology sector, but it's sure looking like it's going to be. If the year ended right now, I think that would probably be amongst the biggest blunders of the year, assuming it would have gotten past any kind of EU scrutiny and it would have, you know, at least, you know, at least got somewhere. But there was a time when it really did look like there was a real interesting opportunity for Microsoft to buy them. And I got to tell you something. I've done an about face on that in the last 2 weeks. I thought there was a reasonable opportunity, but, you know, the amount of money, even though it's a lot less right now for the cost of Yahoo, the amount of money that they'd have to spend on that, rather than making Microsoft, that is making small acquisitions in a diversified manner, because that's really in the big landscape, you know, what they are, their real big benefit is, aside from having cash. You know, when you want to compare, let's say, a Google to a Microsoft, at least Microsoft has a much greater diversification. Again, not better or worse, but just more diversification. So where do we see, what do we see with, you know, with Google? I mean, what's your outlook on this?
On Yahoo. I mean, I
think
clearly, you know, Yahoo's screwed up, right? I think it would be no understatement to say, you know, they kind of screwed up royally. I mean, the stock is down at around $12 or less. It's traded as low as $10. And you know, Microsoft was willing to buy them in the low 30s, and they turned it down as too low. You know, Jerry Yang and the Yahoo board, you know, clearly made a miscalculation here, and they don't look very smart. And you know, I think that, you know, the most recent comments have ironically been, you know, Jerry Yang saying, "Sure, we'd be glad to consider a new bid from Microsoft," and Microsoft basically saying, you know, Steve Ballmer saying, you know, no thanks. We don't want to make a new bid. So the story's kind of flipped on its head. I do think that, you know, if you look at the market share numbers in search, where you've got, you know, Google at about 70% share and Yahoo at 20 and, you know, Microsoft at 5 or something like that, and and then ask.com at like maybe 3 or 4. The options for Microsoft to be a big player in search, you know, their best option remains to remains buying Yahoo, and you know they don't have a lot of other ways to go here. I mean, you could buy all the little pieces that are out there, Ask and AOL and whatever else is out there, and you'd still be smaller than Yahoo and be the number 3 player. So it's not a business that's easy to innovate in. So eventually they still yet may buy them. And but on the other hand, I think that the all the cards are in Steve's hand. You know, Yahoo's going to have a couple of crummy quarters ahead. You know, there's just no way they're going to have a good quarter in December. It's unlikely they have a good quarter in March, given what's going on in the advertising world, which is where they get most of their revenue from. So, you know, what happens to Yahoo stock? Well, short of some sort of transaction, it seems likely that the stock weakens from here. So there may be a point where the stock gets cheap enough where Steve changes his mind again. You know, it's his right to change his mind. He's done it before. He could do it again. There's a point where it becomes interesting. Now, you are still talking about, you know, at the current level, I don't have it in front of me. I think the current market cap of Yahoo is maybe around $15 billion. So you'd still probably be talking about, you know, if you give it a healthy premium, you know, up around $20 billion. Is that too high? I don't know. But I think that Steve has the luxury of time on his side. Now, in the meantime, you know, does Google continue to gain share? Probably. So you don't want to wait forever. But I think at some point, the two companies will figure out a way to do some sort of deal. And I don't think either one of them has a choice. As I say, Microsoft doesn't have that many options in terms of trying to gain more share in search. You know, Yahoo went out and looked for other bidders last time around and found none. And if you stop and think about who could buy them, who would want to buy them, it's a pretty short list. It's still a pretty high price tag. You'd need to have, maybe there's some large media company that would want to do it. But the list of potential buyers is short. So I think that the one other option that Yahoo has here, which they could choose to take, is to sell their Asian assets, their positions in Yahoo Japan, which is a separate public company traded in Japan, and Alibaba, which is a, you know, an Asian internet company, and a couple of other things, and a piece of a company called Gmarket that's based in Korea. They could sell those assets, raise cash and use it to buy back some stock. That would probably buy them some time with the street, but I don't think that's an ultimate answer. There is a potential that in an interim step, which also might buy them some time with the street, that you could see management change. The street is not happy with Jerry Yang and Sue Decker, some sort of dramatic move to by the Yahoo board to bring in someone from outside. Sort of a la, you know, I think Mark Hurd at HP.
I think it's the best idea because, you know, right now the problem, generally speaking, is a lack of confidence from the top down, not only in technology, Yahoo. I mean, we're talking about everywhere. So to bring in somebody that can maybe bring a lift in, especially that, you know, that Jerry Yang, even post this whole issue, has shown such a poor level of leadership in terms of any kind of rah-rah and any kind of positive aspect on the overall process. I mean, you know, not even coming from any strength, and then turning all over, almost over like recently and looking so weak in that commentary he made last week or 2 weeks ago about, you know, well, maybe, you know, Microsoft will buy us. I mean, that just looked like just a pathetic, turnaround.
Well, really, yeah, very sad. Jerry took a double whammy, you know, within the course of a couple of days. You had Ballmer saying, you know, no, actually, we're not that interested in buying you again. And you had their Google outsourcing deal kind of fall apart under pressure from the Justice Department, which was clearly not going to let them do this. I'm not sure why anyone thought. I mean, the Justice Department sent very strong signals that allowing Google to have even more control of the search market was not something they were inclined to allow to happen. And, you know, with a new administration that's likely to be a little more aggressive on antitrust matters. It just never seemed that
I have one last question. Sure. I have one last question for you. About a year ago, I wrote an article, eBay going to 10, and I listed a lot of reasons why that was. And frankly, I really didn't expect it to get that low. Mm-hmm. I was really a little bit overshooting, not for any other reason, but you know, conceptually, it could get there, I thought. And I cannot believe it's even close to that level at this point. And one of my basic the thesis was, there's a lot of different things, but one of the basic components was that they're having such problems with fraud, particularly when you're trying to sell anything higher end than a shoelace. And I've tried personally to sell things on there, and I invariably, you know, I get sideswiped by someone in Nigeria or somewhere around the world trying to do something oddball to me and taking my entire, my auction offline. But eBay, you would think, you know, if you step back, just think about what they are, right? An online garage sale of sorts. Mm-hmm. You would think, even though they're retail, you would think that should be something that in an economic downturn could actually be interesting because more people would want to sell things to raise money for themselves and people looking for bargains. But somehow that's not happening.
Well, I think there's a couple of things going on at eBay that are causing them trouble. I mean, well, one thing is they've made some changes in the structure of the fees on the site. They've also made a lot of sellers unhappy. They've also done some things where they've kind of shifted the focus of the site away from small sellers using an auction system to more of a conventional more conventional sellers, kind of corporate retailers selling things on a stated price basis. So it ends up looking a little bit more like Amazon. And I think that they have this belief that that's where the opportunity lies. But in a sense, they've alienated some of their traditional auction sellers in the process. There have been a few other problems. They have. They're hurt by the stronger dollar. They have a large presence in Germany and some other places in Europe, and the strong dollar really hurts them. Their reported results, so that's also a problem. I suspect that volumes on PayPal do not benefit from a softer economy, so that's a problem. But I think at the core level, the biggest issue they face is that there's just signs of. There's very little growth at the moment in the core eBay marketplace right now, and the current CEO who came in to replace Meg Whitman really hasn't had any success in kind of energizing their user base or their shareholders. So I don't know what happens there. I mean, you know, there has been speculation over time that they would do something like try and zero in the business by maybe selling off Skype or other pieces of the business that aren't core. But I think at a basic level, they have to figure out a way to excite their core sellers again and make them think that eBay is on their side. Because it's interesting on my blog. Every time I write about eBay, you get a flood tide of commentary from eBay users who are very frustrated with the current direction of the company, and it goes beyond the current economic situation. So I think one thing to think about as you look at any company in this environment is casting blame on the current environment for things that are really more structural. We saw that on Friday with Sun, where Sun announced these large layoffs we talked about earlier. And,
yeah, by the way, Sun, do you think they were, obviously, apparently, what was that whole MySQL buy? $1 billion on MySQL. Was
that hasn't really played out very well, has it?
Oh, boy.
You know, their market cap's down under $3 billion, and they paid about $1 billion for MySQL.
And by the way, how much did MySQL, what was the revenue stream of MySQL, remind me again?
De minimis. It was small. they were making a bet on, they've kind of placed all their cards on open source software, and that was their bet on open source database software hasn't worked out. But what I was going to say is that, Sun laying off those 6,000 people and kind of talking about changing economic environment, that's not entirely honest, I would say, in the sense that, Sun was in trouble already. The street had been clamoring for them to make layoffs long before we saw this downturn. It's been clear that their cost structure was out of whack and that they were going to have to reduce their payroll, and so they were able to blame it on the downturn. If you read the release, but that was not the whole story. It was again, it's not the problems in the economy are not the whole story for eBay. There are other companies that are in that situation, but it does give them air cover to be more aggressive, to make deeper cuts, which in the end, they would have needed to do anyway.
Yep, I hear it. Well, Eric Savitz, Barron's Tech Trader Daily. I encourage everybody to take a make a bookmark on that site, because you cover things, writing things left and right. And the news that comes out these days, I think, written no better by anybody but you. And thank you so much for joining me today.
Well, thanks. Thanks for the fun.
What I thought would be helpful is to have someone, an expert, talking about earnings, because earnings have been very concerning. So I thought my friend Howard Silverblatt from S&P, Standard & Poor's, who covers the equity universe at Standard & Poor's, you know, the guy who's responsible for looking at the earnings and then presenting it so we know what's going on in all the different sectors. And he does a lot of work in that area. Very smart guy. Howard, how are you?
I'm surviving, waiting another hour for Tokyo to open up, and we'll see how we go.
So Howard, we're looking at some pretty very bleak numbers when it comes to earnings projections, especially in some recently reported numbers on the earnings. And I was wondering, how does that break down? How does it look from area to area, company to company, or at least, what's going on with the S&P 500 in terms of the earnings outlook?
The breakdown totally changes the picture. The higher look is that the index earnings for the third quarter is down 22%, with financials being literally in the red for the fourth quarter. But if you strip out the financials, you've got an 18% gain overall. That is a great number in these times. And we're seeing that the cash flow is in the low teens. So they're making the money. The non-financial companies, there's a few in the consumer discretionary that's got a difficulty. And, of course, the energy is making tons of money. They now contribute 40% of the earnings. Third quarter last year, they were only 18%.
So tell me something. What happens when we see the next quarter, when we see energy turning around? Because obviously the earnings, based on a lot of the oil price. What happens if we continue to see the downstroke in the financials, or at least leveling off but not anything good, and we see the energy companies, which had such a large contribution, suffering at that point? What do things look like then?
Well, we also have to realize that we're comparing it to the fourth quarter of last year, which was not a good quarter to begin with. So the comparisons become much, much easier. But yes, the energy should taper off a bit because of the cost of oil and the percentages there and the redying there. The financials, though, I'm not too sure whether or not they're going to improve that much. This was a devastating quarter, but we're looking probably at more write-offs. Don't forget, the TARP is not going to support any of the marked markets. So there's not going to be that extra support. And if you're going to write something off, fourth quarter is the time to do it and move on to 2009. But it's going to be a lot harder fourth quarter, especially in consumer discretionary. But since the comparisons are so much easier to beat, again, the fourth quarter last year, we were down over 30%. We should be able to show actually a gain fourth quarter, but investors really need to look at that and say that's because of last year was so easy to beat.
Right. So what happens if you strip out both energy and financials? What does the rest look like?
About a 1.1% decline for the quarter. Going forward, it would look like we might actually have a little bit of a gain, but there's still a lot of optimism in the fourth quarter and the 2009. If you look at the estimates, the analysts have not come down that quickly. They're still waiting for some more guidance, and they don't want to pull the trigger and basically wipe out Q1 and 2. Everyone's talking about the second half of 2009, but if you look at these earnings estimates, I mean, the PEs are in the single digits.
Yeah.
I mean, everything is great.
Which is interesting, and because obviously, again, back to that tale of two cities, right? We have the analysts who don't want to, they don't want to get, first of all, they've been wrong for a while as it is, many of them. And now all of a sudden, they don't want to be wrong a second time around. But the same, it's really interesting because, you question with where the market has been and is this really, are we valued correctly? Because I hear so many stories, people saying, oh, take a look at these values. We haven't seen values like this in however long it's been, and a great time to buy. That was really, I think, the bounce off the 7,800 last week was besides program trading, I think people were saying, well, look at these valuations. We're willing to pull the plug, or at least not pull the plug, but pull the trigger at this point. But it still seems to reason that if this consumer, which is the real core of our economy, continues to be just totally shut down, as we saw. I mean, you saw these retail numbers last week. That was not a pleasant experience.
And it's not going to get any better with Monday. You got Lowe's, you got Target, Tuesday, you've got Home Depot. You know, nobody is looking for good numbers. The consumer is concerned. They're scared. They have no idea of what's happening, and they're not the only ones. Down on the street, I mean, we're looking at these things, and, you know, we're scratching our heads. We haven't seen this much difficulty. I mean, the earnings, again, do look nice for 2009. It's about $92 on the S&P. But, you know, 3 months ago, it was 110. And these things are going to come down a lot more. The strategists and economists, we do the numbers, it comes down to about $70. You really have to look at the company, you know, the individual company. It is a stock picker's time, you know.
So what happens? So let's talk about a little bit about, you know, where we've flip-flopped a little bit here. I think you and I have talked about the whole idea of liquidity and the whole idea that, you know, first of all, many companies are just as – they're almost giant consumers, right? They're not spending. They're not doing any capital expansion. They're not doing any much acquisition. There's just no IPOs. Everybody is, in a way, kind of frozen. As a matter of fact, let me tell you something. I have some people I know over at GM. And if GM doesn't go down because of all the problems that they have, generally speaking, they're going to go down because there's no productivity happening at GM because everybody's walking around the halls, as I understand it, kind of looking at the ceiling and wondering what's going to happen next. And I think there's a gigantic – I don't think it's been explored, but I think there's a gigantic productivity issue that's happening in America right now because of the fear, whereas people are eyeballed and looking at in corporate America, you know, they're watching stocks, they're watching the markets, they're watching their companies, and not really paying attention to the longer term issue. But that aside, the big issue in terms of liquidity, you know, how is that going to, first of all, what's going on with that, and how's that going to maybe turn the next, turn the leaf so we can move past this?
Well, the liquidity crisis is now the liquidity problem. I mean, it is working its way through the system, all the money that's been put in, both domestically and international. Still difficult. Everyone is still scared, especially bank-to-bank, institutionals. But it is easing up. So the liquidity crisis is now the liquidity problem. In a day's notice, it could go back. But right now, it's the problem. The current crisis, as you said before, with the consumer, comes down to the economic crisis, unemployment, a lack of confidence, poor earnings, poor margins, retail pulling back, companies pulling back because they see the consumers pulling back, you know, one following the other. So we are all right now in a economic crisis that has to be worked out. And if the consumer doesn't get the confidence in it, they're not going to start to spend. You know, the consumer confidence was at an all-time low last month. Some people look at that and say there's a positive item because if they got out of the market, there won't be any more selling. There may not be any more selling for them, but they're not going to the stores and buying. You know, you said the retail numbers, they're going to get a lot worse. These margins are squeezed. We even see this on the higher end, Neiman Marcus, Nordstrom's, you know, the higher end, it was a little bit more insulated. You know, people are concerned. The higher end has a lot of money in real estate, a lot of money in the market, and they are hurting, and they have no idea either on what's happening, you know. We had that 18% gain in the market right up to the election,
right,
which was basically hope. And then we did kind of an inverted V, you know, like the carrot on top of the six on, you know, that you always have to use for the quotes.
Yep.
And went right back down to there. You know, when the reality comes, it's not going to be easy to swallow, and it's not going to be good, and there's going to be a lot of bickering back and forth because a lot of people are going to make money off this situation, but something's going to have to give one way or another.
Yeah.
And the investors right now are concerned. The two items investors have to get worried about a lot is the L word, liquidity and longevity. If you've got those two, you're golden. You look at Warren Buffett. One understand the business does in two sentences or less. He's looking for 5 or 6 years down the road. How's it going to be? And I think he can live with it, knowing that he didn't get it at the bottom, but it's going to turn. Not this month, next month, but over the long time period. And investors need to be able to take that and to do that as well. If they're going to play the markets short term, it's going to be dangerous. You've got a great potential for gain there, but if you do it wrong, you're going to be devastated.
Yeah, no, that's what we – listen, hedging has been the name of the game here, and sell stops and making sure you're nimble right now. But let me so what areas – so whenever we talk about liquidity, what's been the biggest surprise to you in this whole – you know, this whole how long is this going on now? 2 years? What's the biggest surprise that you've seen in all this that, you know, I constantly look at all the news and every half hour I'm shocked at every news item that is – it's almost nonstop of craziness.
Well, looking back over the last couple of years, I mean, the idea that Fannie, Freddie, Lehman, Bear Stearns – I mean, we would have discussed that a year ago today. I mean, you might have come up and said, yes, Fannie and Freddie, there's been a lot of talk about their accounting and stuff, but the idea that they wouldn't be here in the forms they are, or AIG would be so far down, I mean, it was ludicrous. It was almost unheard of, in spite of everything we know about bubbles, you know, and perpetual buying. I think that's the most, that institutions have changed so much, I mean, from a personal side. From an investing side, the lack of confidence out there. The breaking of the buck, you know, after the Lehman situation on the money market. I mean, there were people going out and getting money from the their machines to hoard, worried about that they're going to run out of money.
Yep.
Now, I mean, you know,
I have told my clients 2.5 years ago, I told my clients that if they have a HELOC, if they have a home equity line of credit, and they have any concerns at all, I want them to open that up. I want them to take the money out of the home equity line of credit. I'm not kidding about this. 2.5 years ago, take the money out of the home equity line of credit, put it in a CD or a bank, just let it sit there till whatever is about to happen blows over, because the banks are going to be tightening up. They're going to be closing down home equity line of credits, and they thought I was nuts. And I personally did that, not because I'm worried per se of anything immediate, but you know, there's a lot of weird things happening out there, and to lose the opportunity seemed assuredly a better option to protect myself. And I think that's what a lot of people are doing, is kind of, you know, doing the protective route right now in the face of you know, risk. I mean, there's no appetite for risk right now.
And you're going to have to pay if you take any of it.
Right.
Investors are nervous. Companies are nervous. Governments are nervous. I mean, this is unprecedented. But again, we still dealing with an economic situation as compared to the liquidity, where we had no idea where we were going. You know, going back to the 30s or 1907 with Morgan. The economics, we've been down before. We have an idea, at least we hope we have an idea, a concept of what's going to happen, what the unemployment could do, what the retail could do, what the consumer do, what the government can do, you know, to help that, or the Fed, although we're approaching zero pretty soon.
Mm-hmm.
But at least we have an idea of what we're dealing with. You know, investors really need to know their portfolios. But, you know, if you've got time, there's a lot of opportunities out there. I mean, I look at dividend stocks, non-financials, you know, and with the average yields being close to 4% on companies that are making money, you know, those non-financials, again, 18% that they did last quarter, that they positive cash flow, they've got product that I can understand. I don't need to get two PhDs to figure out, you know, what they're doing and what the payoff is. You know, so we're seeing to some degree also back to basics in a lot of those. We're seeing dividend investors going to things like utilities that they can understand, realizing that they have a problem with the rates, of course, and with the oil, depending upon how that goes, but that it's kind of like a consumer staple that's done, you know, relatively better than the rest of the market, in that it's going to continue on and looking for some kind of safety in dividends. So we're seeing that to some degree. We're also seeing it in bonds, individuals going into bonds, you know, for some safety and preferred stock as well. That's been overlooked for a while, but when we had the difficulty with Fannie and Freddie and later on, I was shocked by the number of investors, usually older investors, people who have retired, that have been put into preferreds.
Mm-hmm.
And again, the vast majority continue to pay. Their stock price is down. The yields are up. But using them to get income on a day-to-day basis. I was shocked at it. And when I spoke to a lot of financial planners who deal with individuals, you know, not on the million, you know, the tens of million dollar level, but, you know, lower down where they're putting in $50,000, $100,000, $150,000 into a single preferred. They've got a couple of preferreds as part of their portfolio. It was very prevalent.
Mm-hmm.
Those people are the ones that are now looking for more safety.
But again, many of them, I haven't seen too many preferreds really dropping rates, and many of them still paying, but I agree with you.
That's correct.
In the middle, it looks pretty awful. I have a question. Do you cover the mutual fund industry itself, you know, the companies that have mutual funds, whether it's Legg Mason or Franklin, or do you have familiarity with those?
Well, I have a familiarity. I work somewhat with them, but we also deal with them on a business level, so I'm limited to what I can say.
Well, let me ask you a question. First of all, I've been pretty vocal about my concerns about the industry. Again, you can, you know, tell me when you can't say whatever. But I've been very concerned about them. I saw some recent numbers by TrimTabs today. There's almost a mirror effect with the amount of sell-off in the mutual fund area and the buy-in in the ETF area. And one of the problems I've been having is, mysteriously, a few weeks ago, we had a $540 billion announcement by the Fed that they were going to utilize money to shore up money market mutual funds. And everybody was very unclear where that money came from. But nonetheless, we were also unclear about what that money was really going to do. You know, was it being allocated? Was it being, what's happening with this money? And it's interesting because it seems to me over the years that mutual funds have been having to take the fees from the money markets, let's say, and waive their fees, which is once upon a time was a very lucrative area for them, the money market mutual funds. And money is coming out of their mutual funds left and right, maybe moving into their money markets. And I question what the long-term earnings potential for companies that now have, like on Morningstar, one star. Legg Mason has a one star across a few of their funds right now. And again, the disclosure, we're short Legg Mason. And, you know, it really strikes me as a real interesting phenomenon that why would anybody buy a mutual fund right now when they can have an ETF, assuming it's a normalized ETF, that you can trade throughout the day and you pretty much have a relative clear transparency of what they have in their portfolio as opposed to a mutual fund that you have no idea what they have.
Two items. One, that, you know, the transparency is good, but and you know exactly what you're getting. But if you go into the fund that you have a bit more faith and confidence in the manager, okay, you might not know what he's doing, but if you've got the faith and confidence and they can produce you, you're going to get better off. As far as the actual numbers themselves, I'll leave that to Charlie Bitterman from TrimTabs, who does an excellent job on that.
So what industry do you and maybe we'll close on this point, but looking forward, is aside from the financials, well, let me ask you this. Let's talk about the financials for a second. TARP changed last week to something that we don't know what's going to be, it seems, or we don't know. I don't know. I don't think that instilled confidence in me. As a matter of fact, I said, oh, my God, I cannot believe that. That's I didn't like it to begin with, but then this is even worse, it seems to me. And we have the GM issue, which we don't know what's going on there and what's going to happen. I mean, there's a lot of things up in the air right now. But what's going to happen with these financials? I mean, there's a lot more deleveraging and a lot more write-downs going to have to happen. Are we going to see a tremendous amount, a need for additional infusion? I mean, where are we going here?
I think we are going to see a lot more write-downs. And we're talking the mega billion dollars, especially in the fourth quarter. There's more M&A going on there, you know, healthier companies or supposed relatively healthier companies picking up the small ones. And they're not going to want to pick up the companies and then have to write things off. So those companies are going to start writing off. And fourth quarter may be a time for that when we have a couple of deals probably, you know, just about pending to close on us. That plus, again, the idea that the TARP will not support the portfolios. And putting more cash into the bank might help the liquidity issue, but it's not going to help the housing. You know, the companies cannot do anything about the housing situation. They can't change the rates. They can only position themselves to take advantage to the best they can. So the financials are a difficult area right now. They're going to remain under pressure going short-term meaning well into 2009. And at that point, we'll have to see, you know, how the new Congress and the new president address it. As far as the GM goes, obviously, tomorrow is going to be, as you said, a new day. Congress for the lame duck is coming in. Reid is pulling the Senate in for caucusing. And it's going to be an old-fashioned political battle to see, you know, what's done and what can get done and push through. So that's politics, and that's even harder than the market.
Yep.
But it is a difficult item there. You know, the old saying, what's good for General Motors is not the situation. But, you know, when you look at some of those numbers, you know, which started out at 2.5 million jobs were connected, and now they're saying 3.5 to 4 million. You know, it's a hot potato.
And that's funny you mentioned hot potato. I was just interviewed on NPR, and I said that's exactly what it is. I said it's a hot potato. They're going to pass the next Congress, you know, trying to give them a little bit
of
money.
Well, they're going to try to do something now, but it may have to go into the next one, you know. I mean, yep. GM has made commentary, you know, about the ability to, you know, run out of some money by the end of the year. The union's involved on that. The politics is involved on that. And the legality, you know, with the, you know, can the TARP actually give money? You know, that has to be addressed by Congress
mm-hmm.
as well. So
that
is an open issue, and it's got so many facets to it on there. But consumer discretionary, as the group, is under a lot of pressure also. Don't forget, you've got the housing in there, and you've got the suppliers to the housing.
Right, exactly, and the automotive. All right, so everybody, listen, if you want to find out information about the S&P 500 or any of the global or the domestic subsectors inside of there, I believe they call them the global, the GICS, right? You call them the global.
That's correct. That's
exactly. You go to spglobal.com. Howard Silverblatt covers the much of this and the equity side of things. Great guy. Thanks for your hard work. And it's been obviously a lot harder these days than it ever was, probably.
It
just doesn't stop. The good news just doesn't stop coming.
No, we're having more fun than ever. And I'll tell you, just off the side of it, I am downtown 31 years. I don't remember the bars being so empty at night.
Really? Really? Interesting. Hey, thanks so much for joining us. And everybody, like I said, there's lots of free information and information that you can use to really peg where things are. I have one final quickie. What is the lowest P.E. ratio on the S&P 500 in history that you recall?
The lowest? You go back to about the 30s when it was at 6 at some point. But if you look at the 2009 right now, some of these numbers are in the area there. I mean, you've got an energy having a 2009 PE, as of Friday at least, of 6.5.
Wow.
I mean, obviously the earnings have to be adjusted on there. But even if, you know, they're off their mark and the earnings, you know, falter a bit, I mean, 6.5 is a low PE no matter how you do it.
Right.
But most of them are under 10. The S&P itself is under 10. It was 9.5. You know, even tech is pretty low.
Right, which is giving everybody a lot of hope, but let's just, you know, see how it all plays
out. Right, we need to check those earnings.
Exactly. Thanks so much for joining me. We'll talk to you soon, buddy.
Okay, take care.
I'm going to call it quits about here because I can't stand all the good news that's coming out. And I will see you next week. I want to make sure that you do stop by the Strategy Lab at MSN. And also, of course, do me a favor and check out the disciplinedinvestor.com because we'll have a lot of information there for you throughout the week as best as possible. Write a couple of different pieces on mutual funds again, talking about some of the earnings issues there and some of the outflows. So we'll see you next week. Hopefully we'll have some better week ahead, where we can actually say that the markets were a little bit more cooperative. But either way, you know, my feeling is as long as the markets are open, there's an opportunity to make some money. So nonetheless, we'll see you next week on the Disciplined Investor Podcast. Thanks for listening.
The Disciplined Investor Podcast is sponsored in part by Horowitz & Company, a registered investment advisor and money manager. The information presented in this podcast is not intended to be used as the sole basis of any investment decisions, nor should it be construed as advice designed to meet the investment needs of any particular investor. Some discussion contain forward-looking statements which are based on current expectations and differences can be expected. The Disciplined Investor's host, Andrew Horowitz, is a certified financial planner and registered investment advisor regulated by the SEC. None of the information presented should be construed as an offer to sell or buy any particular security. As always, use your best judgment when investing.